Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is January 24th, 2019, and this is episode 122. Politicos is the BC Politics Podcast. Tell us what you think by leaving a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Blamboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. We're recording our final show in my Kitsilano studio before I move this weekend, because I'm now joining the landed gentry. And so we'll find a new place next week to record. But on today's show, we're going to do a deep dive on the Plekis report, because this is gold. It's just podcasting gold. But first, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. So let's talk about the alleged truckload of alcohol and much, much more. I printed it off on scrap paper, two pages per sheet, just to save a bit of paper, but 76 pages. I guess the background is this is what we've been waiting for. This is the laundry list. This is what Daryl Plekis told us would make everyone throw up when it came out.
Yeah, so for a bit of background, back in November, all of a sudden the House voted to suspend the clerk and sergeant-at-arms at the legislature. They were promptly marched out of the building
by Victoria Police.
Yes, and everyone was kind of left scratching their heads. Over the next month or so, questions got raised, you know, why was this happening? And that was a big issue because apparently nobody had asked that at the time before the vote. And then in December, the Legislative Assembly Management Committee, the committee that nobody ever pays attention to.
It also hadn't really met much,
yes,
to be fair.
Had
which it turns out is prophetic.
Yeah, there was a that met in December, and there was a big argument over whether or not Plekis should reveal this, why he asked for these two people to be suspended, and promised us that in the new year we'd get the report on it, and, well, this past Monday it got released.
So the initial LAMSI meeting this week, it wasn't clear if anything was going to come out. There, even at the start of the meeting, Mary Polak was saying, we should release everything. We should even release the legal advice we are given on whether we can release anything, which, I mean, they're all technically allowed to break their privilege.
Yeah, I mean, they're the clients, so like they get to decide what to reveal.
But generally, you don't reveal that information because you kind of give up some cards that you might need later. And so everyone kind of rolled their eyes at that. And then they went in camera for a couple hours, and we'll never know what happened there. But after, it turns out they were willing to release Daryl Plekis' full 76-page confidential report, which I think reading it is what he also wanted, but he just wanted to make sure that LAMSI had its decision respected. And it's great. It's so great.
Well, I mean, it's bad in the sense that, like, what is in here is not good.
No.
But it makes for some entertaining in a somewhat bad for our public institutions way.
Yeah. I mean, the overall takeaway is if the many, many allegations in here are true, it points to a deep structural culture of entitlement and pissing around with public dollars.
Even
frankly,
if like a fraction of it's true, it's bad.
Yeah. I think the best place to begin is with Daryl's own account that's in the background, which starts on page 6. There's sort of two things that really set this up early in his account, both about everyone's sort of focused on the liquor cabinet story, and I'll come to that second, but he talks about how early on Craig James, clerk of the House, explained to him that Daryl should go to James if he wanted information about the other divisions of the legislature, and he'd be the conduit to take care of that liaising in case it needed to be done. Later, Plekis finds out that James had gone to all the other departments within the legislature and told them that he would be the conduit. So as soon as someone's controlling that information, it kind of puts up a flag that accountability is falling down.
Yeah, I mean, though there is also just like reasonable, like smooth flow of information thing. Funnel. Like that, it's not inherently suspicious on its own, but it gets really suspicious when everything else comes out.
And that's, I think, the whole lesson of this. A lot of these are so trivial, but each individual trivial thing that could be explained on its own.
Mostly. I mean,
mostly. Some of them are definitely...
The alleged truckload of alcohol is pretty hard to explain.
Yeah. But the second thing that kind of starts throwing flags in Daryl Plekis's mind is when he's in his office and he's told that there's a jug of water, a bucket filled with ice, and fresh flowers there, and the water and ice would be fresh, refreshed twice a day, and flowers are placed every week. And he says he opened the cabinet and saw it was full of liquor. Looking at the bottles, I recognized one of them and remarked, "Gee, that's an expensive bottle of scotch." My new assistant said, "Mr. Speaker, you can have any kind you want if that's not good enough." He says it's been his previous experience that the government does not pay for alcohol for staff or members' personal consumption, so this was surprising to him. And it's, I don't know, someone can throw up a defense that having a bit of alcohol around isn't the worst thing in the world, allows him to entertain. It's what you'd expect in the business world, maybe, in a CEO's office. But in the Speaker of the Legislature of the province of British Columbia, it was a little weird. And so those kind of feelings are going on in Plekis' mind, and that leads him into conversations that, you know, he has very early on with Craig James, where James is asking for a life insurance policy because apparently he's paying it out of his own pocket, but he thinks the legislature should be paying it. And he keeps like trying to get this on the books, but it's never like a formal contract renegotiation. It's just like, here, sign this thing. And Plekis in his like first couple weeks is like, I guess I'll sign that. I'm sure it's been approved by someone. And a lot of his initial approvals seem very much based on the people are saying confident things and I'm new here. People wouldn't try to take advantage of me. I'm from Abbotsford, where everyone's nice and friendly. It does have a very gee whiz, I'm from small town and now I'm in the big city. I guess this is how things done. Oh, wait, this is not a good way to do things kind of feel. And so James goes on about this life insurance requested a couple times. And I was going to talk about this a little bit later, but it kind of ties into also this retirement payout that James kept coming forward with, which it's too complicated to really recount on a podcast here, but it ties back to a policy they had in the early 80s before James was hired, which was like 87.
No, I think it was like there's a 2-week overlap basically there.
But the point is James is trying to claim a $300,000 payout, which he did get at one point, and then he was trying to get again, even though he's not retired.
And the program was discontinued like 87.
Yeah. So the whole thing is messy, but that one relates to hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so we're starting to get into big business there. But let's talk about travel, because that comes up a lot. Because these guys like to get around.
Yeah. So one of the other things that arose suspicion from Plekis was when the three of them went off to the UK and kind of did a whole lot of nothing, at least in terms of business stuff. They had a few meetings. You know, one with MI5, because why not have the Speaker of the Legislature of a province meet with British security services?
Boys in Short Pants came out before us on this and mocked this pretty heavily. But technically, BC's legislature has had a terrorist threat against it. And so the Sergeant-at-Arms, who's in charge of security, does have some justification for wanting to be prepped for that level of threat. And MI5 seems like a good place to talk to.
Yeah.
I mean, there might be better ones, but...
And the Speaker has overall responsibility for that, too. So like, it's not inherently unreasonable, but it's still a bit of a stretch that that would be the point of contact. And turns out, yeah, they didn't actually talk about all that much. You know, it's the sort of thing that could have been handled in a briefing note or something.
Or
a phone call.
Dinners are, quote, purely social. You know, being there and making contacts can be valuable, but again, in each of these cases, you could maybe justify one, but when they're then...
It basically is a quote-unquote work trip when almost no work got done.
But they did go to a lot of suit stores and gift shops. So on this first trip, they go to Eden Ravenscroft, which I guess is the store that sells parliamentary robes because they needed to get a fancy speaker's hat for Daryl. I don't know what the tradition is, if they always go and get a custom hat. I imagine they get a custom hat. I don't know if they always travel to London to get it.
Seems like the sort of thing you could call a tailor in, have him take some measurements, and email that to London.
But what was a little bit more troubling about this visit is, while there, James and Lenz, who are both there, kind of browse the store, and they end up finding a couple suits that they like, and Lenz goes to buy one, and he just says, oh, it's all part of the uniform, because there is a dress code to work in the legislature. But the suits they buy in this case was a navy-colored suit, and later they get a gray suit. But in both cases, the Legislative Assembly's dress code is black suits. And this suit was £662, or $1,100, which is, I guess, what a nice suit costs. I've never spent that much on a suit. But when you're getting the wrong colored suit and just kind of joking about it, allegedly. And then they go over to the gift shop for one of the many gift shop appearances, because apparently that's what you do everywhere.
And whole table with this all laid out.
This time they just bought souvenirs, scotch, stationery, and it's later when they buy the mustard, but you really wanted to talk about mustard.
Yeah, so one of the many gift shops that they stop at is the British Parliament's gift shop, where among the many items of stationery and chocolate they get is mustard. And it turns out if you actually go onto the Parliamentary Gift Shop website, they sell exactly one type of mustard, which is gunpowder mustard with Guy Fawkes on the tin, which is like kind of weird. Like I'm not going to pretend I get the British culture around this, but like it seems weird that what was essentially a religious terrorist attack is kind of branded onto things they just sell those. It'd be like going 500 years in the future and having New York sell like Bin Laden branded bagels or something. It's just weird.
Okay, but because I've read this so thoroughly, I know that Fox comes up elsewhere in this report.
It's kind of a recurring theme. Like they bought another trip. They got boots on the gunpowder. Like it's powder plot end.
And when they go to Richmond, Virginia, for the National Legislative Services and Security Association training conference, and this is Gary Lenz and Daryl Pluckis. Lenz, of course, also brings his wife and daughter, and Mr. Lenz's specific presentation was on Guy Fawkes himself. So, nice little tie-in there. Maybe he's just got a little passion for parliamentary terrorists. So, they also, of course, go to the Scottish Parliament gift shop when they're in Edinburgh, and Mr. Lenz ends up buying cufflinks, a women's brooch, trinket box, and other things that were all quote, miscellaneous uniform items at a cost of $160. A brooch he buys, he had joked he was going to get for his wife. And then they also go to a gift shop at St. Andrew's Golf Course in Scotland and bill the transport both ways on almost all of these situations. So they end up taking a lot of limos or, you know, hired cars as opposed to taxis or what Plekis would do, which is apparently take the tube in London, which I'm totally cool with, but I can understand at least if you're like four people on a business trip taking a taxi.
Yeah, the long and the short of it is basically everything that happens on the trips gets expensed to the legislature, and there isn't really any accountability on it.
And I think the only other thing I really want to highlight of the trips, and I mean, there's lots more we could talk about, the like luggage that was bought on a couple times when they just like stuff a extra shirt in there to be like, see, we needed that.
Well, and on the China trip they go on, it's literally $1,000 impulse buy in the airport, and that gets expensed.
But the thing that's really highlighted, especially in the detailed breakdowns in the latter half of the report, are the per diems. And it seems like, according to the records Daryl Plekis provides, Craig James likes putting down for full per diems almost every day on his trips, whereas Gary Lenz will sometimes, you know, go, all right, I was provided lunch or breakfast by the hotel or this. And then Daryl is like judicious about it. He's like, I am only claiming per diems for the meals that I bought, which I think is the policy and at least good ethics.
Definitely sounds like the legislature's policy on this. I mean, some organizations don't want to deal with like individual receipts or whatever, and they'll do like a general per day thing. But like in this case, yeah, the policy is you don't claim a meal that you get fed by someone else. Just reasonable.
Yeah. The other reasonable policy the legislature has is employees are given a set number of vacation days per year and are asked to actually take most of those, both for their financials of the legislature, because if people are being paid out vacation days, that's a huge liability that's unpredictable, but also for their mental health, and just it's generally good to take days off of work. But if you go through the records that Daryl Plekis presents, neither James or Lenz seem to take as many days as they're supposed to by the policy, which is at least, I think, 5 or 15.
I think they get like 20 plus days.
They're given 30 to 40 days a year, depending on their time there. Although I think it was Lenz's vacation days kind of jumped at one point from where the policy says to an extra 5 days a year. And that merits further investigation, according to Daryl Plekis. But there are years where Lenz says he's taken no vacation days, and Craig James says he's only taken a few. And yet, Plekis recounts long portions of many of these trips where, for example, Craig James is like flying from Calgary to England with because his family was there. But how did he get to Calgary? Well, apparently he was working. Or there's a whole section on Craig James moonlighting for the World Bank, despite not being an economist, and never taking vacation days while on those many trips.
Yeah, also maybe in contravention of the policies around not having a second job that could conflict with your primary job of being the clerk of the legislature.
So that's all bizarre. And these vacation days payout has like so many extra layers because the ledge does allow them to bank vacation days. And so in some situations, they banked vacation days for a couple of years and then just got paid out for them. But they were getting paid out at their salary at that year rather than when they accrued the vacation days. So they got extra bonuses there. And so Plekis can't even put a number on how much money has been pulled through this vacation day alleged racket. But it seems like a pretty good way to
at the very least, it reveals that there isn't like a robust HR department tracking this sort of thing in the ledge.
Well, and a lot of that comes down to the fact the person in charge of the ledge is essentially the clerk. He's the CEO. And the person in charge of the clerk or who oversees the clerk is the speaker. But Plekis points out he has no tools with which to enforce discipline. So he's both like the overseer, but with no power, which seems like it leaves it ripe for abuse, which has been alleged in full here.
But yeah, so in the narrative, that's the first part of this. Plekis is kind of recalling the story of how this goes. And you get like interesting tidbits, like when he talks about this life insurance and retirement payouts with the deputy clerk. The deputy clerk's response is, "I can't believe he's doing it again," which means there's clearly been some issues before. And it's like, hasn't, like, people have known about it and it hasn't necessarily risen up to the level of, oh shit, we better actually correct this.
Yeah, that and one other comment that I'll bring up in a second really highlight that it sounds like this is a well-understood phenomenon. Anytime you have like a toxic workplace, everyone kind of has their whisper network of, oh yeah, so-and-so. And everyone knows, but no one says it loudly because they don't want to get sued or fired. And it seems like people may have been fired, but Plekis talks about how he talks to 16 people for this. And the other person he quotes in this, at least, is a conversation he has with the deputy sergeant at arms, where he's talking about this alleged alcohol theft of a truckload of alcohol that we'll come back to. But the deputy says, oh, that theft's nothing. What about the wood splitter? So Scott, tell us about the wood splitter.
So the wood splitter, it's, well, exactly what it says. It's a device that splits wood if you are too lazy to do it the old fashioned way with an axe. Turns out they cost around $3,000 and the ledge bought one on behalf of Craig James. And it turns out it never actually showed up to the ledge. And this was, in theory, or at least justified, on the grounds that if a tree fell, they would need this wood splitter to split up the tree.
So it's worth reading from Plekis's report in full, but we'll also mention, in addition to the $3,200 wood splitter, there is a $10,000 trailer for it to sit on. We did a little Googling, and you can get trailers for like half that or less at Canadian Tire. But I don't know, maybe James knows something more about working trailers than I do for tools and equipment.
Also, keep in mind, the wood splitter has wheels and a trailer hitch on it. Like, it didn't need a trailer to carry it around.
There's additional tools. So Plekis is curious about this. So he reaches around, and this part of the report is written in the third person because he's trying to be more analytical about it. And so he says, from the speaker's inquiries, he understands the justification for the Legislative Assembly purchasing the wood splitter was that if a crisis situation befell the Legislative Assembly, and if in the course of that crisis, a tree fell on the legislative grounds, there could be a need to split the tree up for firewood for use at the legislature. You know, the power's out, it's cold, we need to start a fire to keep everyone warm. However, the speaker has difficulty accepting that rationale, as the scenario seems very remote, and in any event, even assuming external emergency services were not able to attend and handle this scenario, a chainsaw and axe would appear to suffice. Now, notably, when you look up what a log splitter is, you can't put a tree in it.
No, so
it's a thing about the size of a couch.
Yeah, it's designed to split up sections of log and
into firewood.
Someone actually found the wood splitter because it had mysteriously been returned to the ledge.
So that's actually mentioned in this report. I missed it the first time. But Plekis writes, on December 4th, 2018, Mr. James's lawyers, Baskin Martineau, wrote to the speaker and advised that Mr. James wished to deliver the wood splitter to the Legislative Assembly. The RCMP intervened and now have the possession of this wood splitter. The trailer was not at the legislature precinct as of November 20th, 2018, but the speaker understands from facilities and maintenance staff that it subsequently materialized, parked in the parking lot without any indication of how it arrived there. And so a few days after this report, inquisitive journalists actually found the wood splitter, and within minutes, all of them had taken pictures of it and posted it to Twitter.
Yeah, so if you don't on Twitter, you can see it. So yeah, it turns out this specific model can take a 24-inch log in length and split up.
And split it in 7 seconds.
Yes.
So that is actually probably faster than people can do it. So.
But notably, 24 inches is a lot shorter than most trees. So should one of the very few trees on the ledge ground actually fall down, by the time it's ready to be put in this wood splitter, it's already being chainsawed apart and making this a little redundant.
The other thing to point out is if you're going to burn wood in a fireplace, it needs to dry out. You can't just chop a tree up and start it on fire. It's usually still pretty moist, so you have to let
especially
it dry
in BC.
For a year. Yeah, in Victoria.
Also, there aren't many places to burn firewood anymore in the ledge. Although it turns out, this clerk's office actually does have a fireplace.
Yeah, there's apparently a fireplace in the speaker's office, but that's where they keep the mace. And then the clerk's office has a potentially working fireplace, as the premier has informed us and a couple others. But James's defense for holding the wood splitter on his property was he had been advised by Legislative Facility Services that there was no room to store that item within the legislative precinct. However, Plekis writes that that's surprising given the size of the legislative precinct, and if there was indeed no space to store it, then that begs the question of why it was purchased. He thinks this merits further review, but I think most British Columbians can go, why do we own a wood splitter?
And why was it kept at the clerk's house? Now, the one thing I do appreciate is there's something very BC about having a part of a major scandal be a disagreement on how to properly split wood, on proper tree logging practices.
Well, the thing I think everyone will be outraged by if the wood splitter is too amusing is the alleged truckload of alcohol. So early in the report, he mentions that people had talked about this stolen truck of alcohol, and I guess it's one of the myths that goes around the Legislative Assembly staff, because no firsthand accounts are made of this story. Plekis has heard about it from people who have heard about it from people who saw it happen. But the story goes that when BC Liberal MLA Bill Barasoff was Speaker, who was Speaker before Linda Reid, at some point during his term, in around 2012-2013, there was a conference in the Okanagan. And after this conference ended, the clerk apparently took alcohol that was left over, loaded it into a truck, and then the truck was never seen again. And apparently three Legislative Assembly staff helped load this truck, and it may have even come back and done another load of alcohol.
So there may in fact be two alleged truckloads of alcohol.
Plekis did find receipts for this period from BC liquor stores and distribution branches, totaling about $8,800, which
be a good party.
Seems like what a truckload of alcohol would cost. I'm just ballparking. There's not much information here because he doesn't have any firsthand accounts, but he does say multiple witnesses made independent allegations about this, but it's not been corroborated. So we're teased by this thing, but we have to investigate this more. I think this is a full royal commission on the truckload of alcohol. If the clerk is allegedly misappropriating whole truckloads of alcohol, Plekis also questions expenses which, quote, appear personal in nature. And so he highlights the large amount of money spent on digital subscriptions claimed by Mr. James. Now, frustratingly, Politico's Patreon does not appear on this list, and I think that's an oversight by the clerk's office. But that would be a legitimate expense because they need to keep up with BC politics. And some of these magazines listed, like The Economist,
Times of London,
yeah, Wired magazine even, maybe, could be seen as legitimate expenses for an office to keep up. However, Bicycling Magazine, Arizona Highways,
Electric Bike Action,
Palm Springs Life, or Flight Radar 24 seem a bit more confusing.
My favorite one is Maritime Traffic - Ship Tracking was one of the subscriptions. So, you know, just apparently the clerk's office really needs to know where all the ships are at any time.
When you total all of these up for the entire period, it comes to $5,000. And in 1 month, there was claims totaling $720, because there's also like Apple Music in there, iCloud, and a few more magazines and other claims that you're getting hundreds of dollars a month for all of these subscriptions, including $278 for something called Spot Satellite Messenger, which is supposedly a tracking device that uses Globalstar Satellite Network to provide messaging and GPS tracking. Maybe he was tracking the whereabouts of the wood splitter. And then it kind of goes into just like other minor things that seem very personal, as opposed to office use.
Noise canceling headphones, waterproof camera. Although this one's an office one, is the $785 for Dial a Geek computer support service for items related to his new Apple products, including one case where his Apple mouse wasn't working because it didn't have any batteries in it. And I think that one, I don't have it right in front of me, but I think it was around $170 the taxpayers picked up to have a Dial a Geek come in and replace the battery. Its old guy doesn't know how to use technology, so bills the taxpayer, basically.
Especially for his new iPod that he also probably...
Oh yeah, that was the other thing, is that first-hand witnesses have informed the speaker that Mr. James has a particular interest in Apple products. And it's apparently he's had multiple iPhones, iPods over the...
At one point, he had as many as 9 personal devices paid for by Legislative Assembly. Because, you know, sometimes you need 9 iPhones.
Yes, and between April 2017 and July 2018, apparently reimbursed over $5,000 for computer-related items. Noted mostly Apple products.
The other thing I think to highlight, well, I mean, there's tons of other little expenses, but going back to the alcohol for a second, there's 2 wineries named. One is Painted Rock, which is in Penticton, I'm sure is just a nice winery, but Quail's Gate actually comes up quite a bit. And Quail's Gate is notable because the owners are very prominent BC Liberal donors. Like the connections between the BC Liberals and Quail's Gate are to the point where Ben Stewart, whose dad owns Quail's Gate, is now the MLA for Kelowna West, and the guy who ran after Christy Clark stepped down. So we could say they're a favored choice, maybe. And that kind of brings up the BC Liberal connection, which is it was the Liberals who kind of pushed James into this role. He was 4th kind of highest ranking clerk for a number of years. And then the Liberals decided we needed a new chief electoral officer and didn't have enough time, potentially, depending how it was looked at, to get a new full chief electoral officer in for the HST referendum. And so Craig James was just parachuted in, essentially, as a acting one. And he made what were arguably, according to Plekis, some questionable decisions at that time around some of the government advertising around the HST referendum. But following all of that, he was moved into the clerk's office again as the clerk himself. And this was amid protests of the BCNDP, who said maybe there should be an open a recruitment process like there has always been, and not just appointing someone who it kind of looks like you're appointing because he maybe ruled in your favor one time after you appointed him there. All of this is alleged, and Plekis says none of this is necessarily anyone doing anything wrong, but the appearance matters, and the appearance is bad here.
Yeah, his appointment process wasn't without controversy.
And that kind of leads at different points in this story, Gary Lenz, the sergeant at arms, to be pointing out that, you know, James is too close to the Liberals. There's another point when James is talking to Plekis and saying, you know, he's got dirt on the Liberals. And he says if anyone takes issue with these expenses, he could put an end to it because he, quote, had so much dirt on the Liberals and he could threaten to basically stop paying their legal bills. or quit paying their severance payments, which suggests James has, like...
But is the clerk supposed to be responsible for that? That doesn't...
I don't think they're... Weird. I think they're metaphorical legal bills. Like, he's keeping quiet so they don't get sued or in other trouble. But there's more to come on this story for sure. We see at different points, at least, Gary Lenz, like, coming to Daryl Plekis and saying, we need to get this guy out of here. He's so, clearly so dirty. But at other times, Gary Lenz is clearly, like, just as happy to spend as freely as Craig James. And so it feels like a weird power grab. And then there's this weird recounting of when Gary Lenz basically tries to buy out Alan Mullen by saying, you're a smart guy. We should give you a bit more work. We can bump your salary by like 30%. We'll give you some like roles under the Sergeant at Arms office so we can pay you out of my budget. And we'll go from there. And it reads like, hey, I'll give you some money if you just like don't poke around at anything, which is great.
Yeah, I don't really have much to add to that other than it was odd and suspicious.
And I mean, all of this sort of comes back to these human resource issues, which I think is the last thing to really pull out of this report. And here's where we see time and again throughout the report, these like subtle or overt threats or allegations that people will be or have been let go if they ask too many questions or are given perks if they kind of play along or if they, you know, buy into things. Like the whole case reads like James and Lenz continually trying to get Plekis on side with this spending so that he's as much guilty and in the culture as they are. Because once you've committed a few of the crimes, even if it's accidental, you feel like you can't go public or else you'll get in trouble too. And this is I feel like it's a pretty common gang tactic in other criminal situation, but I couldn't figure out what the actual term for it is. It's like a financial honeypot. There's no sex involved, though, that we know of yet, because there is still an ongoing RCMP investigation, which I think involves additional allegations beyond what's in here.
Yeah, it does mention that this is not the complete list of allegations.
Which is already telling you something. And even Alan Mullen's been going around saying, this isn't a bombshell. This is like a hand grenade. The bomb's coming. The thing that's worked against Mullen and Plekis, and maybe we'll get into this a bit in a second, has been their like grandiose sort of statements before now. I mean, this stands on its own feet as being grandiose and worthy of that. But they almost could have just not been yelling through December and then release this and been like, but I don't know, it added to the drama.
Yeah, in fact, that's probably a good time to segue from the report, because I think we covered most of the highlights, although there's...
The one last thing I wanted to bring up in the report is one specific whistleblower isn't named, but is given the initials AB. And he talks about these questionable expenses of an MLA who was using taxi and claiming mileage on the same day. And he comes out to Global News and Richard Zussman the next day as Connor Gibson, and the MLA he was working for at the time was Linda Reed. And he's saying he raised these at the time. Investigations were done, but they seem to go pretty quick by Gary Lenz and just, oh, everything's fine. And the total amount for that wasn't actually that much, but I guess Gibson just thought it was improper and should be flagged, which seems like the right thing to do. It's not so much clear if he was fired or just his contract expired and he kind of decided or was decided for that he not work with anyone in the legislature in the future, but that kind of thing came up again and again.
So yeah, there's plenty more in here. Like, we kind of just scratched the surface of it.
We didn't even talk about the one who got their car serviced in Vancouver when they came over for trips.
Oh, I missed that bit. Yeah, and there's stuff like they hosted a conference but did it in Washington State for some reason.
So you can see a Mariners game.
Like you said, are you hosting something if you have to travel to another country? Anyway, like, there's just a bunch of other stuff like that, and we'll have a link in the report. Like, seriously, everyone should read this, and, like, just go to basically any journalist Twitter page from Monday, and there'll be all the highlights broken out as well. But yeah, there's a lot more in here that we didn't cover, and we could literally spend hours just going through this.
We might do a spin-off podcast that's just a dramatic reading of different sections, but that might be a bit of work.
Yeah, so, but we should probably segue over then to, well, the fallout from this.
First, it's worth mentioning the statement Craig James and Gary Lenz released, pretty much denying everything. So they say, we are shocked at what the Speaker and Legislative Assembly Management Committee have done today prior to the release of these allegations. No one shared them with us. No one told us what we were being accused of, and no one gave us any chance to respond. they still talk about it being a public humiliation and the compounding of the harm done by releasing this. And I think there maybe is a legitimate point of if you're firing or sort of putting someone on leave, maybe there is a due process element of bringing the allegations to them first. Now, they haven't been fired, but they've kind of been treated in a way that's effectively firing.
Yeah, and it's potentially problematic to have the information come out in the media first. Although the fact that the wood splitter ended up coming back after they were suspended does indicate that there might have been some knowledge of the issues surrounding this.
Well, the fact that their lawyer wrote a letter saying they'll give this back suggests they were talking to someone in the intervening weeks about something. I expect we'll see a much more thorough response from James and Lenz's counsel, because I believe Lamsey has given them like a couple weeks actually just to respond. It's sometime in early February that they have to have their response.
Yeah, I think
by.
Just first week of February they're supposed to have their response back.
So that'll be interesting, because it'll be tough to respond to everything in here in a very quick amount of time, especially when you don't have necessarily access to all your files at work because you're suspended. The other weird bit this week has been the story of Wally Opal, who was helping Plekis as an extra special advisor in the fall, at pretty much the end of last year, sort of brought on when Plekis and Mullen didn't know when to stop talking, and Wally Opal is known as the one you bring in to just not talk, Stone Wally. But Mullen said earlier this week he's no longer working with our office, and Opal stonewalled his own employment status, it seemed like, because he went on the John McComb show yesterday, I believe, and said, oh, I still am with the speaker's office, but I don't know for how long, and if they don't need me, then I won't need to be there anymore, and I have lots of other things going on.
So is he working there or not?
I asked on Twitter, and someone said probably not, and I think other people are still saying yes, namely Wally Opal, which is not encouraging when you're in the midst of a employment and expenses scandal.
Yeah, if you don't know who's being employed, that's troubling.
That's kind of the sideshow. Beyond that, we have a lot of questions still remaining out of this. Namely, I think we still need to figure out what's sitting in the RCMP and special prosecutor's investigation. Because if this is the employment stuff that doesn't touch on the criminal stuff, what can that include?
Yeah, I mean, I could see there'd be like fraud-related stuff. Like if you change the receipts for what you purchased from charcoal to black.
Yeah.
To like you could definitely, I think, make a fraud case out of that. I'll let our lawyer listeners correct me if I'm wrong on that. But like you could see some stuff where, yeah, the RCMP could be brought in just from what's in the report itself. But it also really does sound like there's other stuff that may be more serious.
Well, because when you have a culture like this one allegedly is, that's toxic and full of entitlement, and people are kind of running their little fiefdoms, this is the kind of place where all kinds of other abuses happen. I mean, this is what the Hollywood Me Too scandals have been about. That's not necessarily to say that's going to come out of this, but I wouldn't be surprised. But who knows at this situation, at this point.
Although, so far, there hasn't really been any hints of it.
We didn't have hints of really anything prior to this week. There was maybe a hint at expenses, but even that was still not really confirmed. So I'm just saying I wouldn't be surprised. I haven't heard anything to suggest that anyone has sexually harassed anyone else. The other thing that Twitter spent the last few days really getting in an uproar over was a lot of people on Twitter trying to call out BC's legislative journalists for, you know, being too cruel to Daryl Plekis in the fall and saying, you know, why did you treat him so skeptically and treat him like garbage and focus so much on him when clearly there was something there?
So this report has the, well, what was the inciting incident for everything? That's answered very clearly and detailed. But there's still, I think, a lot of very valid questions on how Plekis handled the whole situation. From some of the stuff in his own report about him signing off on some of the stuff, even after he had questions on it, to how it was handled when the clerk and the sergeant-at-arms were suspended. like, as we discussed at the time, like, nobody really knew, like, why it was. Like, the three house leaders decide on this course of action without really any details on it. Well, and then 3 days, I think it was, like, 3 days later or something, that Mary Polak and the Liberals were like, wait a minute, why did we actually suspend these people? And there's, like, a bunch of stuff like that. And, like, they definitely share some responsibility, too, for not asking the right questions, but, like, there was issues around that, and then, like, not releasing anything for a long time, like, not even a basic, like, there are potential misuse of funds, like, even just something as to even give a very high level overview on what the basic problem was, I think would have put to rest a lot of the questions, at least initially. And, like, having everyone kept in the dark for 2 months on this wasn't great. There was that weird moment where Plekis tried to make Mullen the acting sergeant at arms, and, like, that's never really being discussed on why that happened or anything. Like, there's a bunch of, at the very least, questionable decisions that have been made in the speaker's office.
So one of the things I think we'll, again, maybe never know or won't know for a long time until the Matter of Confidence sequel is written with all the insider information. One of the things we don't know until that happens is who knew what when, because I'm not totally convinced the House leaders were fully in the dark. I could see the situation where they were given enough because they did take a drastic action, and I can't believe that they just, like, had Plekis come before them and say, you need to fire these two guys right now. They had to at least know there was an ongoing RCMP investigation, because that would be a pretty good sign that maybe you should put these people on leave. But maybe they knew more. I suspect no one knew the full contents of this until Plekis had the chance over the holidays to sit down and write it, which, can't imagine what fun he was to be around over the holidays, because he was probably just sitting pounding this out. The sergeant-at-arms things with Mullen was definitely the weirdest and most troubling, but I get the sense maybe he was just like, I want someone who's from outside, because this whole thing feels tainted. But yeah, outstanding question still.
Yeah, like, I don't think this entirely vindicates Plekis. Like, there were some questions on the, oh, is he just, like, making this up out of whole cloth, was the implication of some of the questions that were asked at the time, and, like, that has clearly been resolved, but there's, I think, still a lot that you can rightly criticize how the speaker handled it over. And, like, I think the people doing the, oh, everyone was wrong about this victory lap, are doing that very prematurely.
I think there clearly are issues to be addressed, but, you know, how much of this is fueled by score settling because Plekis was burned by the BC Liberals, and so he focuses in a number of spots on their connections to James, for example, and, you know, that will taint his view. I mean, on the other hand, he can't look back far enough at the previous NDP administration, and I've seen some weird criticism that the NDP should wear these expense scandals because they happen while the NDP is in government.
That's not a great look, or a good argument, I mean. And, like, there's Linda Reed, who's, as we mentioned earlier, has had questions raised about her expenses in relation to this. Like, at the time, then House Leader John Horgan came to Linda Reed's defense. And, like, yeah, that's a much more valid criticism than, oh, we only discovered this after we took power. Which, like, you also then have questions on, well, like, this wasn't a small thing. It's been clearly brewing for years. How did nobody notice this? But, like, I don't think that's necessarily what the NDP should wear, is the, oh, it's their fault because this broke when they were in power.
Yeah, and I think to really break down the mechanics there, the oversight of the clerk's office, as I mentioned, is the speaker. And the speaker right now is not a New Democrat. He's an independent. The previous speakers were Liberals while there was a Liberal government, and before that they were NDP when there was an NDP government. And this connection between, which isn't supposed to be there, we've always had partisan or speakers with a partisan banner, and this happens at the federal level too, but they're supposed to essentially not sit with caucus and not really be a part of their party once they become speaker, because you need both the independents to run the office of the speaker, but also because you're the referee in the House of Commons or the legislature. And so you can't be picking sides so much. And this ability for Daryl Plekis to basically have no political like allegiance anymore. He owes no one anything right now. So he can go this full way and investigate everything and not really care who he pisses off, because he's frankly probably not going to run again. Or maybe now he's going to feel like he's, you know, the golden boy independent and we'll go from there. But we should just say quickly, I think this kills his recall campaign.
Well, I mean, that's still going on.
I mean, it's still technically going on.
It's still technically going on, but it's, I don't think it's gotten any less likely to succeed, mostly because it had zero chance to succeed in the first place. But it hasn't helped the recall campaign.
So I don't think the NDP wears the expenses mentioned in this specifically. But like you said, Horgan's going to bat for the Linda Reid scandals at the time. And I have no doubt there were, we know there were expense scandals under the NDP, from Fast Ferries to Glenn Clark's deck and all these other things that happened, and we probably don't even know happened. We probably don't even have the receipts now because it's so far ago. Systemic issues don't just arise overnight. So a lot of MLAs, except the Greens, who are new to the legislature and have no baggage, are probably going to get caught by this. Last question I have, should Linda Reid resign? Because she's right now the assistant deputy speaker, I believe, and she's been caught up in this because of the, you know, whistleblower about her small expenses, which apparently are minor in the realm of Linda Reid expense scandals historically. But can she be an effective assistant deputy speaker?
I definitely think it raises questions on that.
I think that's all we have on the report for now. I'm sure by next week we'll have a lot more to talk about. I mean, again, I would not normally recommend reading long reports like this, but this one's just fun to read, at least because it's written with such an almost like dry humor.
Yeah.
Unintentionally, maybe.
Yeah. So back during the December LAMC meeting, Plekis famously said that if people don't throw up when this is revealed, he'll resign. I don't know anyone who threw up, although there was plenty of disgust with the wasteful and reckless disregard for the public's money here. But like the general reaction the day this was released was humorous in a way. And I like that's mostly because like this is really bad, but there's an absurdity in how bad it is with stuff like truckloads of alcohol and like random wood splitters. And like that has, I think, led to this being a more entertaining scandal than most are.
Well, I was saying to someone, I think on our Slack earlier today, that this and is a very Canadian type scandal. And I, you know, you called it a very BC type scandal, whichever way, in that there's no, like, it's a misappropriation of funds. That's bad. People did lose their jobs for trying to whistleblower, and that's bad. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, it's a small portion of the BC budget. It's not very consequential. People are going to be annoyed and they should be mad at this. But when you compare it to the scandals and the shit that's happening down south, where like elections are allegedly being stolen by Russian interference and everything else that's going on,
well, like,
that's terrifying and has terrible results. Here, things could be smoother and people could not be fired for saying, hey, you shouldn't expense those things.
It's not the slow motion collapse of our democratic institutions like the way the American system's going right now, but that is a very low bar.
Well, it's also not Brexit, so I will keep our Canadian scandals if it means we don't have to deal with Trump and Brexit. Let's go into quick takes and move from BC scandals to federal possible scandals involving where people's residence is. And specifically, former Minister of Multiculturalism and now United Conservative Party of Alberta leader Jason Kenney, who, it turns out, according to Kyle Morrow on Twitter, claimed as his residence from 2013 to 2015 when he was Member of Parliament, his Calgary residence, that is, as in the home that he would live in most of the time, as the basement in his mother's retirement village bungalow, specifically the one at Lake Bonavista Village Retirement Residence in South Calgary. It's not clear, according to The Star, whether people who are not retired seniors can claim a residence in this bungalow, but apparently Jason Kenney did, and this raises questions because he maybe wasn't living there, and maybe he was just living in the condo he owns in Ottawa while claiming the I live outside a reasonable distance from Ottawa expense from the federal government. And it also raises questions about his ties to Alberta when he's running to be premier of Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
And it also spawns a whole bunch of Jason Kenney's mom's basement memes.
I mean, it would not be the first time a politician has made dubious residence claims. I mean, one would have hoped... Actually, no, these were back around the time the Duffy thing was breaking, right? So I was going to say you should have learned from it, but like this... Actually, no, 2015. Now that's post-Duffy. Like, that's the fact that didn't get cleaned up at the time. Like, it shouldn't have happened in the first place, but not even having it cleaned up post-Duffy, yeah, that's bad.
The estimates would total this cost to taxpayers as being about $130,000, which is not insignificant. Jason Kenney has denied he's done anything wrong. We'll have to see. I mean, we have tweets out there like, "Conservatives, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Move out of mom and dad's basement and make something of yourself. Jason Kenney, hey mom, if I pretend to live in your basement of your retirement residence, can I get free meals too?" These are good times. We'll have to see where this ends up. Kyle Morrow pulled the actual expense receipts off the Government of Canada's website, which is something that's now being encouraged the Legislative Assembly of BC to start being more transparent about, because they do not have as transparent procedures inside the legislature as they do for MLAs. And apparently that means you can get away with a lot more. Yeah. Jason Kenney, I guess, would be right at home working for the legislature of BC if this whole Premier of Alberta thing doesn't work out for him.
It's a hot take.
Who else has hot takes?
Well, that would be our ambassador to China, who earlier this week, when he was back in Canada visiting, held a presser for Chinese language media, where over the course of 45 minutes, he went on to basically say that Meng Wanzhou has a very solid case to fight the extradition to the U.S., citing several reasons, such as that Canada isn't participating in the sanctions against Iran that the U.S. is, which, like, that actually isn't what she's being charged with. It's bank fraud, which is very much a Canadian crime. And, you know, a few other things like that. And basically politicized, which a decision which really should not be political. I mean, there's a political dimension to it, but he's brought the government, kind of made it a very political thing for the government rather than what everyone was saying before, which is we're just following the rule of law on this one and letting the courts decide it.
The line, "I'm not going to comment on a matter that's before the courts," is arguably well overused in modern political climate, because there is actually a decent amount you can say about issues that are before the courts. You just don't talk about your specific legal arguments. You let those be made in court.
But it does exist for a reason.
But yeah, one of the good reasons not to comment is to counteract your own side's arguments. Like, when your team is making a legal case, you don't go, "Yeah, we're probably going to lose this one." Not because it necessarily biases the courts. I don't know that it would. But it makes your team look stupid and bad, and you look like a fool. So, unsurprisingly, McCallum walked his comments back. He says he misspoke, and they do not accurately represent his position on the issue, which kind of begs the question of what his position actually is. I guess it's just the government position now.
Well, that's the question, is what is the government's position? Because when he first made these comments, there was a question on, well, did he kind of just go off script? Has the government changed its position? And, like, keep in mind, this was a, like, prearranged presser where, he invited a bunch of people and spoke for, 40 minutes on it. So, it wasn't to a Chinese audience. Like, this wasn't just someone passed him on the street and he made an off-the-cuff remark. But, nobody actually, or, it was never actually confirmed that this was the new stance Canada was taking. So it's led to this question floating around for the past day on, well, was this, an officially sanctioned thing? And, no matter what, it's a bad sign, because either our ambassador to one of the most important countries in the world is just going off script on major sources of tension between the two countries, which is bad, or the government has changed tact on this and is basically willing to kind of back down on what should be a fairly straightforward, "No, we're just going to follow our procedures, let the courts come out as they will," and the fact that China's playing dirty by holding a couple of our citizens hostage shouldn't affect it.
Well, and it's worth remembering, McCallum's a long time liberal. Like, he was a backbencher under Chrétien, and then a minister for national defense, for veteran affairs, for national revenue, and then elected again under Trudeau. He was minister of immigration from Trudeau's election until January 2017 when he retired, and then he was appointed ambassador to China. So he's very close with this party.
Yeah, in fact, this was done right after he went to Ottawa to brief the Canadian government on this.
And so it's kind of not surprising that the sheer conservatives are now saying, hey, he should resign for these comments, and they would have a clear interest in that, since they probably wouldn't want someone who's a longtime liberal, but also these comments aren't great for a ambassador to be making. So maybe Scheer's on the mark with this one.
Yeah, I think it's especially if McCallum ended up going off script, which, I mean, given all the other stuff that happened around it, probably wasn't necessarily off script. But yeah, either if it was, like, yeah, that's definitely something I think you could reasonably be asked to step down from the post over. And either way, like, this is a very delicate situation. And if he was delivering the government's new line on it and did it in such an indelicate way that he had to walk it back a day later, like, that is not necessarily the type of skill you want in a diplomat who, speaking carefully on sensitive stuff, is kind of one of the core job descriptions.
Well, the other person who's being asked to step down is Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who is...
Officially, it's not considered the president by Canada anymore.
So Maduro's been facing growing protests. He's the socialist leader of the country whose situation has gotten dire as the economy of Venezuela has collapsed as oil prices dropped, because the only way you can build a socialist country, it seems, is to have a lot of oil money to do it. Don't tell Alberta, because they never figured that out. But when oil prices collapse, you can't afford to feed all your people. And so, like many collapsing regimes, he got more authoritarian and...
Well,
sort of
they were pretty
ranks.
Authoritarian before.
But they started shutting down democratic.
Like they decision, the Venezuela.
He started centralizing power a lot more.
Yeah, it was already pretty centralized before. Like, his predecessor had closed down a bunch of, or basically taken over the various media arms out there. Like, there's a bunch of stuff. Like, Venezuela's problems with democracy did not start with Maduro. That's been a long-running problem under both him and his predecessor, as has the general economic problems. But that they've definitely gone particularly acute in the last several years, as inflation has hit 1,000,000%.
That's normal.
Yes, and like Venezuela can't have food anymore because can't buy it with their crazy inflating money. Like, there's basic necessities like toilet paper, medicines are inaccessible or basically only acquirable through the black market. Like he has royally screwed up an economy in a way that very few people have ever managed to screw up an economy that bad.
Well, and things do get more complicated because any country that gets too socialist in the world's eyes, especially the US, tends to upset them. And it's a chicken egg problem whether the nationalization of the oil is the cause or the sanctions that the US inevitably imposes for when you
I will point out that the Venezuelan state oil company was basically the only oil company that wasn't making money at $100 a barrel. That's actually, like, I get people have trouble making money on some types of oil productions at $40 or $60 a barrel, but like, they screwed up their oil company well before the crash.
Oh, I'm just saying, if no one's willing to buy your oil because they hate your economic system, that does affect things, so it's more complicated. Anyway, they're in a shitty situation. And so the leader of the opposition, who's the leader of the majority party in the National Assembly, which basically has no power because of Maduro's recent changes.
Yeah, when his party got trounced at the congressional elections, he's like, screw you, I'm creating my own Congress with blackjack and hookers, and created this whole new legislative body that he basically stacked with his people.
The leader of that opposition party is Juan Guaido, trying our best to get that correct. He's a 35-year-old engineer, which basically describes the both of us, except a slightly older.
I'm 28.
I just turned 33. So Guaido's done I guess, more with his life to become, well, in his words, the new president of Venezuela, because he appeared earlier this week and just took an oath before a crowd to be president and then disappeared.
So yeah, he did this citing a couple provisions in the Venezuelan constitution it's a little vague.
And neither of us are Venezuelan constitutional scholars.
So with with that asterisk, might allow the leader of the legislature to step up if there is no legitimate executive power. And like after the rigging of the past election, like there's an argument there. Like the point, it's complicated. We're not going to resolve who the rightful ruler of Venezuela is right now, but it's not clear either way.
Well, someone who did resolve it is Donald J. Trump and his administration, who very quickly came out and said Guaido is the right and proper president of Venezuela, and we will make sure he is recognized as such by any and all means necessary, including force.
Which is,
that escalated quickly.
Yeah, and Donald Trump, of course, does nothing with tact or subtlety, which is, pretty much par for the course at this point. But it's worth noting that, it isn't just the U.S. We've recognized Guaido, as have many Latin American countries, in addition to, I believe, the EU.
In Latin America, you have notable progressive countries like Brazil under...
Yeah, but you also have Argentina, Chile...
Colombia, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, Paraguay, and Peru right now.
Yeah, and
And Ecuador.
The American imperialism argument's been thrown around a lot, but when you have that list of countries, who also have bad memories of that era, signing on to this, it's not...
To be clear... I don't think any of them are supporting the same level of foreign military intervention.
Oh, I don't think anybody. The U.S. is pretty sure out alone on this. And on the opposing side, you kind of have Russia, Turkey, China.
Well, in Latin America, you have Bolivia, which is being run as a socialist country right now. You have Cuba again, El Salvador and Nicaragua, and Mexico is sort of hedging its bets but siding with Maduro, which is a smaller list.
Yeah.
Of pretty much socialist or left-leaning countries.
And outside the region, it's more... the countries that I believe have taken a strong stance against this are the ones that generally do not appear on anyone's good democracies list. So it's... I don't know. Given the choice between being on a list that includes the EU and the US versus Russia and China on how government should run, I think I know which list I'd rather be included with.
I'm still conflicted. I find most reporting on Latin American politics to be superficial, not just in terms of this kind of story, but it's really hard to, because I guess as someone who doesn't live in the country, it takes a lot of backgrounding to really fill it in. I'm not saying Canada should side with Maduro in any way, but I don't know. Do we have to come out and say we recognize one or the other? We can just say we support free, fair, and democratic elections. We hope they have some. And just kind of back into a corner. Is that wrong?
So the useful context here is that after the 2018 election that was, quote-unquote election that was rigged by Maduro, Canada come out and basically said, that is not cool. You need to step down and actually hold proper elections. So this isn't just an out of left field, just, out of the blue, we're deciding we aren't towards Maduro. This has been building for a while, and the Venezuelan crisis has been going on for years now, and the Maduro government's pretty much the main obstacle to fixing it at this point. And every time the situation gets worse, they're doubling down on the policies that got them into the situation.
I just want a little more consistency, I think. When Jair Bolsonaro is elected in Brazil, the election is deemed fair, despite the threats faced against his opponents and the strength of that. And Canada is like, oh, congrats, Bolsonaro. And you're like, he's a fascist, right? There's this debate, is Trump a fascist? Is not? No, Bolsonaro's lock the gays up and kill them all. He's a bad guy. Let's just be consistent. If we're going to complain about the democratic fairness.
I think there are kind of two different levels here.
Yeah, I think Venezuela's was much worse. Yeah. But we should be not friendly with Brazil right now if we like some element of liberal democracy.
Yeah, so kind of hard to argue with that.
Yeah. But anyway, Venezuela's fucked up. It's not going to get better, especially I think the worst thing we can agree, the worst position to take, I think we can agree, is the Americans. Yeah, we're ready to intervene to help make sure this political changeover, to put it in a non-calling it a coup way, happens.
Yeah, I think any military intervention at this point would be premature and a bad idea. And that has been Politicos. Find links to everything we talked about at politicos.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe. And let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Thanks for listening.